Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Eliza Griswold, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation, a poet and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity. Her latest book is I Am the Beggar of the World, Land Days from Contemporary Afghanistan. And she has an article at Slate Magazine, Why Fear Boko Haram? Welcome to Background Briefing, Eliza Griswold.
Thank you very much for having me.
And you, in your first book, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity, you write about your run-in with Boko Haram, which was incredibly frightening, and you're lucky to have survived it. And as you point out in your article at Slate, you wouldn't have survived it in the contemporary situation since this happened back in 2007, where they nearly killed a Nigerian reporter with you. And you only escaped after a local elder got you into a car and drove you away. Describe what happened. How did you meet with them? And what was that, the impression of these people? Because we've seen the video of the leader of Boko Haram talking about selling the girls off as slaves, the 200-plus girls that he's seized. So describe your experiences with Boko Haram.
Sure. So Abu Bakr Shekau, who's currently the leader of Boko Haram, was not yet the leader. At that time, a man named Muhammad Yusuf, who was killed by security forces in 2009, was the leader of Boko Haram. And I went to Maiduguri, the main town in the northeast that calls itself sort of the capital now, or Boko Haram really cites Maiduguri as the capital of a lot of their activities. I went to Maiduguri to meet with the group. They were they're still shadowy, obviously, but they were little known at that time. They had been known as Africa's Taliban. They had called themselves that. And they were developing into a hardcore militant group that claimed to want an end to Western education. They hadn't yet begun attacking schools, which they have over the past few years. Of course, we see now exactly how far they'll go. Not only will they kill children who are watching a soccer match, they will burn, they'll lock kids inside schools, set those schools on fire, and exactly as you just said, they just took more than 200 girls, and today it looks like they've taken about 10 more.
And it does seem that the Nigerian government is somewhat helpless or inept, and also, I mean, clearly corrupt, and it's really very distressing to learn that the Nigerian First Lady, Goodluck Jonathan's wife, she was blaming the women who were sitting in protest, claiming that they were with Boko Haram and had them arrested. So what's your understanding of the nature of this government and why it is that, apart from apparently ineptitude, why is it that they can't address this issue or even, you know, allow this thing to happen? This kidnapping took place over many, many hours, and since then apparently haven't really done much, except now they have to do something because of international pressure and embarrassment.
The government is not only inept, the terrain that they are attempting to, the terrain, the Sambisa Forest, where into which the girls were taken, is an incredibly difficult area to access. Now, that certainly gives absolutely no quarter or excuse to the ineptitude and inactivity by Nigerian security forces, who claimed after the first phase of the raid that they had rescued more than 100 of the girls, which was an odd thing to claim. That was the spokesman for the Nigerian military, as they hadn't rescued a single one. So the ineptitude is ineptitude in itself. It's also born, the divisions between the north and the south of the country are born out of long-standing differences, ethnic and otherwise, that predate independence. So the south, where Goodluck Jonathan is from the south of the country, the south's interest in the north and in security and stability in the north has always been low, and at this time it's at an all-time low.
So, in effect, you're talking about this fault line between Islam and Christianity, are you not?
Absolutely. What we're seeing is this very pronounced fault line that lies roughly between the equator and the line of latitude 10 degrees to the north, the 10th parallel. And along that fault line, across most of inland Africa, two religions meet, Islam and Christianity. And in the Muslim north, along this fault line, there are, in Nigeria in particular, but in other nations as well, but Nigeria is probably the strongest example right now, there is a real disenfranchised population. And for many of the Muslims of northern Nigeria, Islam has become a kind of rallying cry, an anti-colonial, anti-Western rallying cry. Let's return to a time where there wasn't corruption, where the government was pure, where we had our needs met. And, of course, you know, the government in Nigeria is so corrupt that despite being one of the world's largest suppliers of oil, the average Nigerian lives on less than $2 a day and doesn't have a right to the most basic services as supplied by the government. That means there's no such thing as free schooling. And that's really where we see Boko Haram spring from. We see a massive, we're talking more than 20 million young, mostly men, in northern Nigeria who go without any kind of schooling at all. Traditionally, there was a form of Islamic schooling that was for free called al-Majri schooling, and that used to be a pretty legitimate way to get an education. And the boys of the north would travel to teachers' farms, and along those farms, they would, in exchange for an education, they would work on the farm. Well, what's happened really along this belt, along the 10th parallel, as a result of climate pressure, those farms, those Islamic farms teachers used to run, can no longer run because the southern spread of the desert. Because the Sahara is spreading south, as a result of desertification, the teachers can no longer run these schools on that farmland. And they move south, they move to the edges of slums, they move to cities. And so the kids who were getting an Islamic education now work for the teachers still, but they work as beggars. And they form a ready army when any political leader needs to kind of hire out a mob. And this really is the roots of the foot soldiers of Boko Haram.
Well, of course, what though is this phenomenon? It seems to be rife in Africa of kidnapping children, using them as sex slaves, and also using them as child soldiers. I mean, you've got the case of Joseph Kony and the Lord's Resistance Army, you know, that I hesitate to call that guy a Christian, but he's nominally a Christian. So it's not entirely to do with Islam, is it? I mean, what explains, is there any cultural explanation apart from poverty and ignorance that one would, you know, abuse, rape, kidnap, murder, and terrorize children into becoming child soldiers?
And, you know, it's not just Africa with the phenomenon of child soldiers. One of the places that we've seen child soldiers used quite a lot in the past, let's say 20 years, would be in Central and South America among, you know, rebel groups like the FARC, I'm thinking in Colombia. So it's not an African phenomenon as much as it's a phenomenon of poverty and lack of absolute any form of good governance, any form of civil society, so that for people to allow their children to be armed, to work as child soldiers, I mean, if you have a gun, at least you're going to eat. And that is a lot of the thinking. Now, the degree to which Boko Haram has taken its example of the mass kidnap of girls from Joseph Kony's Lord's Resistance Army is a curious question. Boko Haram is looking to make an international mark. They are looking to be taken seriously as a terrorist organization. Because the Lord's Resistance Army is currently, the United States has, you know, one of our military objectives in Africa is to kill or capture Joseph Kony, who many years ago took, you know, more than 100 girls from a boarding school in northern Uganda. So the historic echoes are strong here. Whether or not Boko Haram was looking expressly at those echoes in order to poke at the West, in order to wake the United States, is a question. I think it's much more likely that Boko Haram was continuing their pattern of trying to perpetuate the things that they don't have when they're stuck in the jungle, which is sex and help with labor, namely cooking. So the girls are literally, you know, are literally sex slaves and cooks, because those are the skills that the men cannot take care of themselves in the jungle where they are, in the Zambezi forest.
So, Eliza Griswold, what do you make then of the U.S. sending teams in response to this kidnapping and the apparent inability of President Goodluck Jonathan's government to do much about it? Obviously, they're not sending troops in, but they're sending in, obviously, some intelligence assets, and it's a little vague. And obviously, the Nigerians don't want to, their pride would be such, they wouldn't want to admit the extent to which they're being helped out by foreigners, I imagine. So what's your reading on what the U.S. could be doing in response to a conversation that Secretary of State Kerry had with President Goodluck Jonathan?
You know, I don't want to get into too much supposition about the U.S. role in Nigeria vis-a-vis its, the search for Boko Haram. Suffice it to say that we do have, the United States does have, you know, between 3,000 and 5,000 soldiers on the ground right now in Africa. And we do move those assets around as need be from place to place. So it's not new for the United States to have a military presence in Africa, nor is it new to go to the aid of countries that are having internal struggles. So that much is not new. And then that's about as much as I know, so that's as much as I can say.
Well, I spoke the other day with a Nigerian who's been banned from Nigeria. He runs SaharaReporters.com, and he also has been threatened. The Boko Haram have threatened to blow up his office in New York, so he's getting it from both sides. One of the things that he was suggesting was that this camp where these girls are being held is not mysterious. It's quite well known that the Nigerian authorities know about it. Is that your understanding?
That is my understanding, yes.
So what's kind of theaters going on here now?
You know, I think it's a little bit more complicated in that it's not as easy. We've seen this over the years, certainly with the U.S. military presence in Afghanistan and along the border with Pakistan. Just knowing where somebody is certainly doesn't solve all the problems of how to get to them. I would be the last person to make an excuse for the Nigerian military or its security forces. But the truth is, it's not as easy as it looks to conduct an operation against any terrorist organization, let alone Boko Haram. And the stakes of going in and shooting their way in would be to kill these girls as well. So I don't think it necessarily implies some kind of massive cover-up or conspiracy that the Nigerians' ineptitude has made them unable to care enough to go after the girls. I don't think there's more to it than that.
Well, in terms of the deal, though, that the government made with MEND, the group down in the Delta that were frustrating oil shipments and having illegal bush refineries and tapping into pipelines, etc., and driving around in speedboats and with bandoliers and bullets and lots and big heavy machine guns, etc. My understanding is that the Nigerian government made a deal with MEND and literally paid them off. And
there's no comparison between MEND and Boko Haram.
Right.
So, MEND was a bunch of thugs wanting money.
Right.
Boko Haram is a very, very dangerous terrorist organization that has absolutely no interest in creating any kind of long-term arrangement with the Nigerian government or any other. They are looking to create an international presence for themselves as an al-Qaeda-like organization.
So they're not angling for a price, a payoff?
Oh, I'm sure they're angling for a price and a payoff, but they're not angling from the Nigerian government for it, and they won't be anytime soon.
So this is really a fight to the death then, is it? I mean,
yep, I would say that's a safe thing to say. I mean, it depends who you talk to. It depends the level of support you think that Boko Haram garners in the north. There are certainly elements. Do I think that a fight to the death is going to be profitable? No. Do I think that negotiation with Boko Haram should be on the table? I absolutely do, because I don't know that there's going to be any other way to reach these guys without real civilian casualties.
Well, I recall seeing some time back, Eliza Griswold, a video that Al Jazeera was playing of Nigerian soldiers and the military having captured a bunch of, they looked like ordinary villagers, men, who they laid prostrate on the ground. You know, they were just randomly shooting them, and Then one guy admired one of the prisoners' hats and put it on and then shot him. And it was quite disturbing. So what is the level of professionalism in this army? Is there any?
You know, it's a too big question to answer. There's the level of ineptitude at the lower levels is extremely high. There are some groups within the Nigerian military that are extremely highly trained by both Navy, the U.S. Navy SEALs, as well as British Special Operations. There's a group called the Small Boat Service that operates in the south. They have become much more effective. They're in the north now fighting against Boko Haram. There's a lot of pieces from which to look at the Nigerian military.
But in terms then of this fault line that we've talked about with the Muslim north and the Christian south, is there any way to mend that? Or is there, are we talking about a country that should, in fact, divide? Or
no, Nigeria shouldn't divide. I mean, it doesn't have sort of a cogent south and a cogent north. It's a federal, it's made up of 36 states. It's a federal system that is fairly, in terms of being a federal system and distributing, at least in name, having the system set up to distribute wealth. One of the reasons we haven't seen more rage in the north generally against the south is that oil revenues do reach the north as well. So there's widespread endemic corruption in both north and south. Many of the oil-rich states in the south have a higher level of corruption, but it's not as if the north is utterly impoverished while the south flourishes. So the fault line is pronounced. It's growing more pronounced, not only in Nigeria, but across it. A lot of what we've seen in Central African Republic, certainly in Sudan, and across, you know, Ethiopia, as well as some of the tensions between Ethiopia and Somalia, have pieces interlinked with this religious fault line, across which the majority of Christians and Muslims in Africa meet. But whether the solution to that fault line is simply to divide countries religiously, the answer is no. So the solution lies in good governance. It lies in cleaning up corruption. It lies in supplying basic services for everything from electricity to school in rural communities across that belt. And with the increasing GDPs that we see across Africa and the explosive growth of capital and the possibilities for deeper emerging markets, that's really what we see as a solution across most of Africa. And, you know, without that, I should go.
Okay, well, I'm just going to say that they're about to have a World Economic Forum on Africa in Nigeria. And the head of the central bank there recently revealed between $30 and $50 billion have gone missing, and he got fired. So it sounds like there needs to be a better distribution of wealth, to put it mildly.
Yeah, the corruption endemic on every level of Nigerian government is stunning. And until Nigeria is able to address that problem itself, solutions that address the root causes of what creates groups as disparate as Mend and Boko Haram will be impossible to come by.
Thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Eliza Griswold, who's a fellow at the New America Foundation, a poet and author of the New York Times bestseller, The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Islam and Christianity. Her latest book is I Am the Beggar of the World, Land Days from Contemporary Afghanistan, and she has an article at Slate Magazine, Why Fear Boko Haram? We're going to take a brief station break and back talking to a veteran foreign service officer at the State Department on the need for a diplomatic effort to prevent a war in Ukraine.